Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, February 12th, 2022 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane. Today, we will be reading from the following main articles. Tri-City Initiative, unhoused in the suburbs. Englewood, Littleton, Sheridan put boots on the ground in fight against homelessness. Written by John Aguilar. Wildlife-related bills. Legislation deals with insurance, burn scars, and awareness. By Nick Coltrane. Amache National Historic Site Act. Utah Senator blocks designation of internment camp, draws ire. By James Anderson and Sam Metz. Ukraine. U.S. says Russia may invade in days. By Matthew Lee, Afmer Bandani, and Vladimir Isachenkov. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Tri-City Initiative. Unhoused in the suburbs. Englewood, Littleton, Sheridan put boots on the ground in fight against homelessness. By John Aguilar. The Denver Post. Mookie Moore is crouched at the edge of a parking lot on Broadway. 36 years of his belongings stuffed into a cart and backpack that he carries with him wherever he goes. I drift all day and all night, he said on a recent afternoon on Englewood's main strip, crouching outside of the pay-what-you-can eatery Cafe 180. Every day just blends in. His companion, Tyrone Carter, whom he met that day, said his previous night spent on the street was a misery. It was so cold outside, said Carter, as he blasted hip-hop from his phone to a Bluetooth speaker perched on a utility box behind him. It's very hard. Moore and Carter are two of a growing number of people who don't have a place to live in Denver's southern suburbs. They're also the people officials and homeless advocates in Englewood, Sheridan, and Littleton hope can benefit from a homeless initiative that is ready to shift from 3 years of concept and planning to on-the-ground intervention and assistance. Arapahoe County this week signed an agreement with the three cities to hire a homelessness coordinator who is slated to start in the role this spring and remain in place for 3 years. Littleton, Englewood, and Sheridan are expected to sign the agreement in the coming weeks. It's spending the dollars and putting the boots on the ground, Devin Granberry, Sheridan's city manager, said of the Tri-Cities Homelessness Policy Committee's next phase. We want to move the needle pretty significantly. The coordinator will make $110,000 a year, a cost that will be split between the three cities. The Tri-Cities Homelessness Policy Committee, formed in 2018 and made up of civic leaders, service providers, and members of law enforcement across Englewood, Littleton, and Sheridan, has been studying the dynamics of homelessness across the three communities for the past 3 years. Now it's ready to tackle the issue head-on as a global pandemic, coupled with a housing market hit by rapidly increasing home prices and rental costs, has made securing shelter that much more difficult. According to the Metro Denver Homeless Initiative's second annual State of Homelessness report released last month, 32,233 people accessed services or housing support related to homelessness at least once from July 1, 2020 and June 30, 2021 in Metro Denver. Nearly twice the number as the year before. We feel it is the right approach because we're using science and data, and you want to go after the root cause and not just the symptoms of homelessness, Englewood Assistant City Manager Tim Dodd said. Having this coordinator is a critical foundational step because they're going to pull all of this work together. Different face of homelessness. This work consists of two analytical reports from the Center on Housing and Homelessness Research at the University of Denver and a 43-page Tri-Cities Homeless Action Plan that was released last summer. The action plan recommends that the three cities look at establishing a homeless navigation center, a safe parking program, and workforce centers to help those without a home transition to employment. It also suggests the cities activate outreach teams of social workers and other professionals trained to deal with families and individuals suffering from mental illness or threatened by domestic violence. The report estimates that it will cost the three cities $705,000 to implement its recommendations. While homelessness in the suburbs often doesn't manifest in the way it does in Denver, where authorities regularly clear out expansive tent encampments in and around downtown, it's just as real, say those who track it. Not all of the unhoused population is visible, said Sama Fox, Littleton's assistant city manager. It could be families staying with other families or staying in cars. They might not have been captured in the point-in-time survey. The point-in-time survey is conducted on a single night once a year by the Metro Denver Homeless Initiative. It found that the homeless count in Arapahoe County leapfrogged from 228 in 2019 and 245 in 2020 to 523 last year. Some of those cases turned deadly. According to the Arapahoe County Coroner's Office, 43 people experiencing homelessness in the county in 2020 died from natural causes on the street, from drug overdose, or from hypothermia. The pandemic has exacerbated it, said Mike Sandgren, network leader for Change the Trend and a mission pastor at the Wellspring Church in Englewood. Service providers are seeing a lot of new faces, learning a lot of new names. Change the Trend is a consortium of more than 30 agencies and service providers that formed 5 years ago and meets weekly to work on solutions to homelessness in Englewood, Littleton, and Sheridan. Even before the pandemic, the issue was becoming more visible in these first-tier suburbs, Sandgren said. This is not the beginning of the attack on homelessness, but it's an adoption of higher levels of service for the area in the next few years. The homeless challenge in the south suburbs has intensified in recent years as nearby communities have adopted urban camping bans, including Centennial and Parker. Denver has had a camping ban in place for nearly a decade, and voters in 2019 overwhelmingly voted to keep it in place. Boulder has had a long-time ban on camping, and in recent weeks, Aurora Mayor Mike Kaufman said he would bring back that city's camping ban proposal that was voted down by the city council last year. Camp cleanups in downtown Denver have been blamed for pushing the problem to other parts of the city. There isn't good data on whether they also caused some to move to farther-flung areas of the metro area. But in the action report, several Tri-City stakeholders surveyed on the issue cited displacement by Denver police after a series of encampment cleanups as a cause of an increased presence of single adults in the region. Sheridan and Englewood forbid camping in their parks, and Englewood Police Sergeant Reed McGrath said the South Platte River, which runs through all three cities, is designated as parkland and therefore is off limits to overnight visitors. The city made headlines in 2019 when it cleared out a homeless encampment that had sprouted on the banks of the river. McGrath said there haven't been any sweeps like that in Englewood since. Granberry, the Sheridan city manager, said his city takes a softer approach with its homeless population. We don't allow camping, but we have yet to issue a single ticket, he said. It's about getting people assistance rather than enforcement. Right for this area. Meanwhile, the number of those finding themselves without permanent shelter in Littleton, Englewood, and Sheridan could well jump in the coming year. The Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office increased evictions markedly in 2021 over 2020 when a moratorium on evictions helped slow down the pace of removal. According to agency data, evictions in Arapahoe County skyrocketed from 603 in 2020 to more than 1,200 last year. McGrath, with the Englewood Police, said the city is trying to get out ahead of it with a program started 4 years ago that provides co-responders, those skilled in dealing with people with mental health issues, on police calls. And there are plans in the works to roll out a mobile crisis program in Englewood, where teams of people would go to where the unhoused are. Dodd said the Englewood City Council just this week allocated more than $1.5 million of the city's $8.7 million in American Rescue Plan Act funding to address homelessness. Fox, the assistant city manager with Littleton, said the most valuable aspect of the Tri-Cities approach to addressing homelessness is working in cooperation across three communities while also tailoring strategies to attack the issue that work better for a suburban environment. It is different in Englewood, Sheridan, and Littleton than it is in Denver, she said. We are trying to figure out what is right for this area. Wildfire-related bills. Legislation deals with insurance, burn scars, and awareness. By Nick Coltrane, The Denver Post. Stephanie Connors, like more than 350 of her neighbors near Grand Lake, didn't lose her house during Colorado's traditional fire season. It was October 2020, and the East Troublesome Fire was bearing down on the first home Connors and her fiancé had ever owned, one they had bought just a year earlier. Snow, not ash, should have been falling on their car for that time of year, she said. But in a story that echoes from so many Coloradans, she was facing the reality of a wildfire with little regard for time of year and bearing down to burn away her livelihood. Many bills have been introduced into the legislature this year in response to the tragedy Connors and thousands of other Coloradans have faced from recent wildfires, with more measures likely to come as the session continues. Most are still being workshopped or waiting their turn in committee. With the devastating 2020 fire season and the historically destructive 2021 Marshall Fire still fresh in minds, there's a special urgency in the work, members of the legislature's Standing Wildfire Committee said. The recent fires just emphasizes and underlines the fact that we are in a constant wildfire risk period of time, and we have to be acutely aware of it all the time, State Senator Pete Lee, Democrat of Colorado Springs, and a committee member said. Connors, who is now staying near Granby while she wrestles with her insurance company, isn't sure what can be done. She talks with neighbors about the state removing trees killed by beetles to lessen the tinder in the forests, but appreciates that would take a logistical marvel. She appreciates the efforts by lawmakers, particularly one to address how insurance companies handle claims from declared fire disasters. But overall, she preaches preparedness. We're seeing drier and drier seasons for longer, Connors said. Marshall shouldn't have happened when it did. Ours shouldn't have happened when it did. But with these extended seasons and this continuous dry weather, it will happen again. Here's a look at some of what lawmakers hope to accomplish this session for fire preparedness and response. Underscored by Marshall, lawmaker wants to streamline insurance claims for fire disasters. The East Troublesome Fire in 2020 laid bare to State Representative Judy Amabile, Democrat of Boulder, the problem of underinsurance among Colorado homeowners. The fire scorched more than 190,000 acres of land, making it the second largest by size in state history, and destroyed more than 300 homes. Fast forward to summer 2021, and Amabile was hearing from constituents, such as Connors, still struggling against insurance companies to get paid out, getting tangled in red tape over interim housing costs. To submit their insurance claims, they were feeling as if they were reliving the trauma by needing to inventory meticulously the pieces of their lives that had turned to ash. As Connors recalled grabbing a go bag and staying up all night listening to an emergency services scanner for any hint of her home's fate, it was only when she started dealing with insurance that the real nightmare began, she said. Connors and her fiancé are on the ninth insurance adjuster they've worked with since the loss. They haven't even been able to get in line yet on hiring contractors to begin the rebuilding process, she said. Meanwhile, their interim housing coverage runs up in November. What do we even plan for? Connors said. House Bill 1111 aims to make it easier to file and receive initial claims for lost property, ease the inventory process, and extend housing reimbursement, among other things, when a loss is declared as part of a declared fire disaster. It passed its first committee Thursday night on a bipartisan 10-2 vote. Mass property loss in a fire disaster makes it much harder to recover, Amabile said before the hearing. It's harder to find a place to rent. It's harder to get your building permits approved. It's harder to find a builder and an architect. And it's also harder to get your claim through the insurance company because they're also overwhelmed with claims. The Marshall Fire underscores the need for this type of legislation, she said. Homes lost to fire disasters still account for a small percentage of total insurance claims, including such things as hail. But the mass trauma they inflict is dramatic, she said. Obviously, it made it feel more urgent what happened in the Marshall Fire, Amabile said of the bill. It pointed out that no one is immune from this kind of thing happening to them. If it can happen in Louisville, it can happen anywhere. Because so many people are susceptible to natural disasters, the bill has drawn the attention of insurers since its inception. Lynn Elliott, an assistant vice president for Trade Association, American Property Casualty Insurance Association, said she's been working with Amabile since the fall. One of the amendments included dropping the automatic payout amount for items lost in the fire from an initially proposed 80% to 65% of full coverage. Current law allows for insurers to pay out just 30% of the value of a claim, with the remainder covered following a detailed inventory of lost personal goods. According to data presented by Amabile, the new figure is in line with what most of the larger insurers in Colorado have paid out over the past several years. Just two of the 10 generally paid out less than 65% since 2017. Elliott said the big concern is making sure any changes to disaster insurance don't disrupt a marketplace already grappling with billions of dollars of claims in the past several years, including a $2.3 billion hailstorm in 2017 and the estimated $1 billion claim payout from Marshall alone and the rising costs all consumers face. Behind the dollar amounts are individual claims for the companies to evaluate and adjusters who are tasked with what seems to be an ever-rising number of disasters. Or in short, they face their own logistical bottleneck. The primary concern of Elliott's group is moving too far and too fast while circumstances are so volatile. We anticipate there will be more legislation introduced specific to the Marshall Fire that will either directly or indirectly address how insurers are responding, Elliott said. Now is not the time to take drastic legislative steps that would cause any instability in Colorado's insurance market, because consumers lose if insurers can't compete in the marketplace. While concerns about the bill leading to higher premiums were raised at the hearing, no one said costlier plans would be a direct result, especially compared with factors such as the volume of claims from recent disasters. Colorado Insurance Commissioner Michael Conway testified that he doubted there would be a significant effect on premiums given the narrow focus of the bill. I think that's important that you don't overcorrect and cause disruption in places where you weren't expecting to, Amabile said after the vote. So I think I'm really happy with where we ended up. An effort to tend to existing burn scars and use science to minimize new ones. The Waldo Canyon fire burned into the memory of Democratic State Representative Mark Snyder in 2012, as it did for thousands of others. But it wasn't the flames themselves that wreaked so much havoc on his hometown of Manitou Springs, where he was then mayor. The fire's burn scar, where soil-retaining foliage is seared away, left the landscape vulnerable to the next deluge of rain. That deluge came about a year later in the form of a half inch of water that fell in about 20 minutes. Without vegetation to hold the ground in place and soak up the rain, a wall of mud and debris tore through the town. It claimed dozens of buildings and killed a resident who played a beloved Santa Claus at a local holiday attraction, Snyder said. He hopes to increase reseeding efforts for burn scars by expanding the State Forest Service tree nursery with a bill he plans to introduce soon. The changing climate hampers the ability for some burn areas to bounce back, he said, citing still barren parts of the Hayman fire from 2002. If enacted, among other things, he hopes the bill will spur new research into best practices and increase the number of saplings ready to stabilize burn scars. You drive through the Hayman fire, and it was 20 years ago now. It looks like it was yesterday, Snyder said. It just hasn't grown back because of changing precipitation levels and other factors. That's what worries me. Lawmakers aim to encourage mitigation with matching grants. In House Bill 1011, which Snyder introduced with Representative Lisa Cutter, Democrat of Littleton, he hopes to encourage local governments to bolster their efforts at fighting wildfire with a state matching grant. Broadly speaking, a local government would need to have a dedicated funding source for fire mitigation to qualify for a matching slice of money from the State Forest Service. A fiscal analysis predicts it would cost about $20 million in its first full year, beginning July 1, 2023. What qualifies as mitigation would be broadly defined and left to the local government, Snyder said. The state's ecosystem is too diverse to prescribe solutions. The bill has not been scheduled for a committee hearing yet, the first step to possible passage into law. Snyder doubts this will be the only bill to deal with raw dollars and cents, especially with the amount of federal money from the American Rescue Plan Act and bipartisan infrastructure law that passed last year, although what those details look like haven't been made public. Awareness, fuel management draw additional focus. With 3 months left in the session, more bills aimed at wildlife mitigation and response almost certainly will be introduced. Senate Bill 7, introduced by Lee and Senator Tammy Story, Democrat of Evergreen, was the first of these fire bills to pass its initial committee and did so on a party-line vote. That bill aims to create a wildfire awareness month to keep the danger and, more importantly, Lee said, the importance of protecting from the danger top of mind. We have a big wildfire. People engage in mitigation efforts. 2 or 3 years pass and they think, I've taken care of this, Lee said. But the thing about growing things is they keep growing. So we need to engage in constant mitigation efforts. Mitigation and awareness are important aspects of wildlife management, said State Representative Perry Will, Republican of Newcastle and a member of the Wildfire Committee, but not the only part. He's planning to run a bill he called a right-to-burn bill to allow private landowners to make controlled burns on their property to help control the amount of fuel for fires. We've subdued fires for so long now that we have these megafires, Will said. Land management, including proper timber harvest and grazing, needs to coexist with a focus on preservation, he said. Will noted a colleague, Representative Mike Lynch, Republican of Wellington, is running House Bill 1166 to promote the timber industry, which Will said could help with forest and fuel management. Fire management will need education, awareness, planning, mitigation, and preparation, Will said. And although he encouraged those efforts, it's Mother Nature's cooperation that will define wildfires in Colorado. But nature is nature, and its influence on conditions lawmakers seek to address can't be overstated. We get a fire, and people tend to think you can throw money at it and equipment at it, Will said, naming helicopters and water trucks and praising the efforts by wildland firefighters. But no matter what fire we get, Mother Nature bats last. Amache National Historic Site Act. Utah Senator blocks designation of internment camp, draws ire. By James Anderson and Sam Metz, the Associated Press. On the eve of the 80th anniversary of the forced internment of 120,000 Japanese Americans at the onset of World War II, Republican U.S. Senator Mike Lee of Utah is getting backlash for holding up the creation of a National Historic Site at a former internment camp in rural Colorado. U.S. Senator Michael Bennett, a Colorado Democrat, says he has the support of 99 of the chamber's 100 senators to pass the Amache National Historic Site Act, which would make the remote southeastern Colorado landmark a National Historic Site eligible for additional preservation assistance. But his bill, co-sponsored by Colorado Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper, failed to pass by unanimous consent last week because of a lone objection from Lee, who opposes adding new federal lands without adequate funding and in the past has advocated for swaps to prevent expanding federal land ownership. Senator Lee does not object to this specific historical site. He does object to any increase in the total amount of land owned by the federal government as the federal government fails to adequately care for the land already in its vast holdings, Lee's spokesman, Lee Lonsberry, told the Associated Press. A similar House bill, sponsored by Colorado Republican Representative Ken Buck and Democratic Representative Joe Neguse, swiftly passed last year, and Bennett's Senate companion may still advance for consideration. The dispute comes amid a broader reckoning about race in U.S. history as Japanese Americans strive to spread awareness about the gross injustices committed by the U.S. government against Americans of Japanese descent during World War II. The Amachi site is less than 1 square mile, Bennett's office and the Prowers County assessor said. It contains remnants of barracks, latrines, mess halls, military police structures, and a cemetery. Lee has been one of the Republican Party's most vocal opponents of the expansive power that federal agencies have to manage public lands in western states. He supported the Trump administration's 2017 decision to shrink the size of Bear Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, two national monuments in Utah. And last year, he opposed the Biden administration's decision to restore Bear Ears' original borders. In a 2018 speech in Utah, where about two-thirds of land is managed by federal agency, he said his long-term goal is to transfer federal lands to state control. Camp Amachi is owned by the town of Granada and is listed on the National Register of Historic Places. Its current designation qualifies it for preservation funds, but designating it as a National Historic Site would make available additional U.S. funds through the National Park Service. Calling the Japanese-American internment one of the most disgraceful chapters in our nation's history, fed by racist fear, Bennett said in a floor speech February 3rd, the bill intended to honor people who never gave up on the United States of America, even as it was interning them on their own soil. Japanese Americans were held in 10 camps in California, Arizona, Wyoming, Utah, Arkansas, and Colorado, expelled from their homes near the West Coast under an executive order by President Franklin Roosevelt issued on February 19, 1942. More than 7,000 people were interned at Amachi, the camp's unofficial name, after a Cheyenne chief's daughter from 1942 to 1945. According to the National Park Service, a cemetery, reservoir, water well, and tank and trees planted by internees remain at the site, which is managed by a nonprofit, the Amachi Preservation Society. Lee's stance has drawn outrage from numerous organizations, including the Japanese American Citizens League and the National Parks Conservation Association, which advocates for the national park system. The Citizens League, its local Southern Colorado affiliate, and other groups plan a day of remembrance on February 19th that will in part demand passage of Bennett's bill. The initiative not only serves as a healing tool and an acknowledgement of wrongdoing by our government, but it allows individuals and our country to move forward to a better way of being, said Shirley Ann Higuchi, leader of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. Her parents were interned at the Heart Mountain Relocation Center in that state. She noted that her own father, William, went on to become chairman of the Department of Pharmaceutical Chemistry at the University of Utah. Another detainee, Raymond Uno, became Utah's first ethnic minority judge. A lot of Japanese Americans contributed so much to Utah, and it's a shame that in some quiet way they cannot be honored, Higuchi said. They have quietly contributed to our country, and it's unfortunate they can't be supported by someone from their own state. Bennett and Lee's offices said the senators have spoken about how to add the remnants of the Amachi Granada War Relocation Center to the park's system. Ukraine. U.S. says Russia may invade in days. By Matthew Lee, Afmer Bandani, and Vladimir Isachenkov, the Associated Press. Washington. The Biden administration on Friday escalated its dire warnings about a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine, saying it could take place within days, even as emergency diplomatic efforts continued. Adding to the sense of crisis, officials said Biden ordered another 3,000 U.S. troops to Poland. The White House said it still didn't know if Russian President Vladimir Putin had made a decision to invade, but it said Putin has assembled all the elements to do so quickly and told Americans in Ukraine to leave within the next 48 hours. The stark warning accelerated the projected time frame for a potential invasion, which many analysts have believed was unlikely until after the Winter Olympics in China end on February 20th. The heightened U.S. rhetoric followed new intelligence that showed another increase in Russian troops near the Ukrainian border and the start of a major Russian military exercise in neighboring Belarus. We can't pinpoint the day at this point, and we can't pinpoint the hour, but that is a very, very distinct possibility, President Joe Biden's national security advisor, Jake Sullivan, said. The strong possibility of action, the distinct possibility of action in a relatively near-term time frame, is backed up by our view of what's happening on the ground. We continue to see signs of Russian escalation, including new forces arriving at the Ukrainian border, he added. As we've said before, we are in the window when an invasion could begin at any time should Vladimir Putin decide to order it. The Washington Post reported that Putin and Biden are scheduled to speak Saturday as fears of an invasion mount. Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said, "The hysteria of the White House is more indicative than ever. The Anglo-Saxons need a war at any cost. Provocations, misinformation, and threats are a favorite method of solving their own problems." Biden has said U.S. troops will not enter Ukraine to contest any Russian invasion, but he has bolstered the U.S. military presence in Europe as reassurance to allies on NATO's eastern flank. On Friday, the Pentagon said Biden ordered a further 3,000 soldiers to Poland, on top of 1,700 who are on their way there. Together, they form an infantry brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who is in Australia, was the first U.S. official to say publicly that an invasion could come before the end of the Olympics. Repeating Blinken's earlier caution to U.S. citizens in Ukraine, Sullivan said the risk is high enough and the threat is now immediate enough that prudence demands that it is time to leave now. Sullivan would not discuss the details of the intelligence behind the new U.S. assessment and denied a report that American officials believe Putin has made the decision to invade. But he said the situation is increasingly fragile and that the U.S. and its allies must be prepared. We believe he very well may give the final go order, Sullivan said. That is a very distinct possibility. It may well happen soon. Biden spoke to European leaders Friday to underscore the concerns raised by U.S. intelligence about the potential imminence of a Russian invasion. Sullivan said the Western leaders were completely united and would respond harshly to a Russian invasion with devastating economic and trade sanctions. Britain's defense secretary, meanwhile, was visiting Moscow in another effort to ease tensions over a possible invasion. Ben Wallace's trip came a day after British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss held frosty negotiations in Moscow to urge Russia to pull back over 100,000 troops near Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov characterized that meeting in blunt and scathing terms, calling it a conversation between deaf and dumb. Russia opened massive war games in Belarus on Thursday that are due to run through next weekend, but says it has no plans to invade Ukraine. It wants the West to keep Ukraine and other former Soviet countries out of NATO. COVID-19 on hold. Shots for kids under five. FDA reverses course. We'll wait for data on vaccine for age group. By Lauren Neergaard and Matthew Perrone, The Associated Press. Washington. COVID-19 vaccinations for children under five hit another months-long delay Friday as U.S. regulators abruptly put the brakes on their efforts to speed a review of the shots that Pfizer is testing for youngsters. The Food and Drug Administration, worried about the Omicron variant's toll on kids, had taken the extraordinary step of urging Pfizer to apply for an okay of the extra low-dose vaccine before it's clear if tots will need two shots or three. The agency's plan could have allowed vaccinations to begin within weeks. But Friday, the FDA reversed course and said it had become clear the agency needed to wait for data on how well a third shot works for the youngest age group. Pfizer said in a statement that it expected the data by early April. FDA's vaccine chief, Dr. Peter Marks, said he hoped parents would understand that the agency's decision was part of its careful scientific review of the evidence Pfizer has submitted so far. That information made us realize that we needed to see data from a third dose from the ongoing trial in order to make a determination, Marks told reporters. We take our responsibility for reviewing these vaccines very seriously because we're parents as well. The nation's 18 million children under 5 make up the only age group not yet eligible for vaccination. Vaccine experts had been concerned with the sudden race to evaluate Pfizer's vaccine and now wonder what parents will make of the back and forth. I think they made the right decision to be careful and wait for the third dose data, said Dr. Jesse Goodman of Georgetown University, a former FDA vaccine chief. It was great to hear that there might be some promising data from two doses, but it came out as, hey, everybody, you can expect a vaccine in a few weeks, he added. I think this messaging gets very confusing for people. It's not the first delay. Pfizer originally had expected to know by late December if the extra low doses worked for kids under 5, only to face a disappointing setback. Preliminary study results showed two shots were safe and strong enough to give good protection to babies as young as 6 months. But once tots reached preschool age, the 2 to 4-year-olds, two doses weren't protective enough, prompting the addition of a third to the study. So it was a surprise when, a few weeks ago, the FDA urged Pfizer and its partner BioNTech to go ahead and apply. Next week, the agency's independent scientific advisors were set to debate publicly if it was okay to start giving tots two shots before there is proof that a third would give them the extra needed protection, a highly unusual move. Friday, the FDA abruptly canceled that meeting, promising to hold it once Pfizer submits the third dose evidence. Even if Pfizer completes its submission by early April, it will take the FDA and other health authorities several weeks to review and publicly vet the data. This week, the FDA's Marks had promised the agency wouldn't cut corners, but also noted how rapidly the pandemic was changing. Before Thanksgiving, no one had heard of Omicron. By last month, pediatric COVID-19 infections had hit an all-time high, and now cases are dropping fast as the latest mutation burns out. How long to wait for new vaccine data and how much to require is a difficult balancing act for the FDA. It is caught between pressure to be more proactive against the rapidly changing virus and the risk that acting too quickly may deter families already on the fence about vaccinating their children. Pfizer aims to give children as young as 6 months shots that contain 1/10 of the dose given to adults, two shots 3 weeks apart, followed by a third at least 2 months later. That's a smaller dose than youngsters ages 5 to 11 receive, a third of the adult dose. Vaccination rates have been lower among children than in other age groups. As of last week, just 22% of kids ages 5 to 11 and just over half of 12 to 17-year-olds were fully vaccinated, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics. Nearly 3/4 of adults are fully vaccinated. A Kaiser Family Foundation poll taken last month found that just 3 in 10 parents of children under 5 would get their youngster vaccinated as soon as shots were authorized, while about 1/4 said they definitely would not. Dr. Moira Szilagyi, the pediatricians group president, recognized parental frustration, but said a statement that doctors were committed to a careful, robust, and transparent process to evaluate the evidence. Dr. Natasha Burgert, a pediatrician in Overland Park, Kansas, said, "We're just gutted. We need this protection for our kids." She said some families likely feel relieved because they didn't want to make that decision without good efficacy data. Other groups of parents are just crying out, "Give us a choice. Show us what you've gotten and let us make a choice. Let us have access to it." Stepmother of 11-year-old victim, Stotch enters insanity plea. By Kieran Nicholson, The Denver Post. Letitia Stouch, stepmother of 11-year-old Colorado Springs boy Gannon Stouch, whose body was found in Florida after he had been shot and stabbed, pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity to murder charges Friday. Fourth Judicial District Judge Gregory R. Warner accepted the plea, and Stouch's upcoming murder trial, which had been scheduled to start March 28th, is vacated. Warner advised Stouch on Friday of the legal ramifications of entering the plea. She answered a few direct questions with a simple yes and nodded her head. Defense Attorney Joshua Tolini told the court that a psychiatric expert is being brought in from out of state to evaluate Stauch. Prosecutors did not object to the plea. Friday's hearing took an hour, and Stauch's next court hearing is slated for March 17th. Gannon disappeared from his home January 27, 2020. Letitia Stauch was the last person to see him alive. The boy's body was found March 17, 2020, under a bridge near Pensacola, wrapped in bedding and inside a suitcase. He had been shot in the jaw and stabbed in the chest and back. He had suffered a skull fracture. He also had cuts on his arms and hands that appeared to be defensive wounds. Sergeant Jason Yoder of the Santa Rosa County, Florida Sheriff's Office said at a hearing in September. Gannon's body appeared to have been in the suitcase for some time, Yoder testified. Authorities found a bullet in his skull and two bullets in a pillow that was with him in the suitcase, Yoder said. Authorities believe Letitia Stauch killed Gannon in his bedroom while the two were home alone. During Stauch's preliminary hearing, prosecutors presented evidence that she initially dumped his body near Colorado 105 and South Perry Road before renting a van and driving with her daughter to Pensacola. Stauch's hotel in Florida was about 3 miles from the spot where Gannon's body was discovered. Letitia Stauch's DNA was found on a 9mm gun inside the family's home, and investigators found a significant amount of bloodstains in Gannon's bedroom. His body was found with bloody bedding and a pillow that was missing from the family's home, and a bullet found in Gannon's head appeared to have been fired from the 9mm gun. On the day Gannon disappeared, Letitia Stauch asked her teenage daughter to stop by a store and buy carpet cleaning supplies, baking soda, trash bags, and other items around 5 p.m., according to an affidavit. Marshall Fire. Cleanup expected to cost $52.6 million. By Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. The company hired to remove ash and other debris from the sites of homes burned by the Marshall Fire says it can do the job for $52.6 million, although Boulder County officials warn the price tag could fluctuate because of the nature of wildfire recovery work. Boulder County's commissioners on Thursday, in a 3-0 vote, hired DRC Emergency Services to clear the ruins of the hundreds of homes destroyed in the December 30th wildfire. County officials initially did not disclose the dollar amount of the contract awarded to DRC, but they did so in a news release late Friday afternoon, noting that DRC offered the lowest bid. The firm will pay the county on a per-parcel basis. Bids from the 11 companies competing for the contract range from $52,641,495 to $199,020,527, the news release said. The next lowest bid behind DRC was for $55.5 million. However, the amount Boulder County eventually pays could change based on a number of factors, including how many local residents choose to participate in the public cleanup project. So far, 900 property owners have submitted applications, the news release said. The deadline to enroll is Monday. The cost of the project also could change if most houses need their foundations dug out and refilled with dirt, and if the amount of hazardous waste at the burn sites is greater than expected. Debris removal on private properties is expected to begin March 1st and should be completed by July 1st, weather permitting. Late Wednesday, the Federal Emergency Management Agency notified Boulder County that it would cover much of the cleanup costs. Typically, FEMA reimburses a county 75% of the costs, while state and local governments pick up the remaining 25% of a disaster cleanup bill. However, Boulder County continues negotiating with FEMA to seek reimbursement for certain aspects of the cleanup, such as digging up the foundations of burned homes. The work will involve hauling away the ash and debris on residents' properties, including toxic waste such as asbestos, to the appropriate landfills. Several inches of topsoil at most residences will need to be removed because of contamination, and the company will be required to cut down any trees damaged in the fire. The contract also requires DRC to recycle metals and concrete when possible. The Marshall Fire killed two people and destroyed 1,084 homes worth a combined $500 million in Lewisville, Superior, and parts of unincorporated Boulder County. The county is leading the debris cleanup for all three local governments, and the representatives from Lewisville and Superior have been involved in selecting the company. Environment. Judge strikes down Biden climate damage cost estimate by Matthew Brown, Matthew Daly, and Kevin McGill, the Associated Press. Washington. A federal judge on Friday blocked the Biden administration's attempt to put greater emphasis on potential damage from greenhouse gas emissions when creating rules for polluting industries. U.S. District Judge James Kane of the Western District of Louisiana sided with Republican attorneys general who said the administration's action to raise the cost estimate of carbon emissions threatened to drive up energy costs while decreasing state revenues from energy production. The judge issued an injunction that bars the Biden administration from using the higher cost estimate, which puts a dollar value on damages caused by every additional ton of greenhouse gases emitted into the atmosphere. President Joe Biden, on his first day in office, restored the climate cost estimate to about $51 per ton of carbon dioxide emissions after the Trump administration had reduced the figure to about $7 per ton. Former President Donald Trump's estimate included only damages felt in the U.S. versus the global damages captured under the higher estimate. The Biden administration's revival of a higher figure initially set under the Obama administration would be used to make future rules for oil and gas drilling, automobiles, and other industries. Using a higher cost estimate would help justify reductions in planet warming emissions by making the benefits more likely to outweigh the expenses of complying with new rules. Known as the social cost of carbon, the rule uses economic models to capture damages caused by rising sea levels, recurring droughts, and other consequences of climate change. The $51 estimate was established in 2016 and was used to justify major rules such as the Clean Power Plan, President Barack Obama's effort to address climate change by tightening emission standards from coal-fired power plants, and separate rules imposing tougher vehicle emission standards. The Supreme Court blocked the Clean Power Plan before it ever took effect, and a more lenient rule imposed by the Trump administration was later thrown out by a federal appeals court. The carbon cost estimate had not been used very much under Biden, but is being considered in a pending environmental review of oil and gas lease sales in western states. Federal officials began developing climate damage cost estimates more than a decade ago after environmentalists successfully sued the government for not taking greenhouse gas emissions into account when setting vehicle mileage standards, said Max Zirinsky, a professor at New York University. Not fully accounting for carbon damages would skew any cost-benefit analysis of a proposed rule in favor of industry, he said, adding that the social cost of carbon has been instrumental in allowing agencies to accurately judge how their rules affect the climate. Without a proper evaluation of climate impact, it would complicate agencies' good faith efforts to make reasoned conclusions, he said. Republican attorneys general, led by Louisiana's Jeff Landry, said the Biden administration's revival of the higher estimate was illegal and exceeded its authority by basing the figure on global considerations. The other states whose officials sued are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, South Dakota, Texas, West Virginia, and Wyoming. Landry's office called Kane's ruling a major win. Biden's executive order was an attempt by the government to take over and tax the people based on winners and losers chosen by the government, the statement said. A federal judge in Missouri last year had sided with the administration in a similar challenge from another group of Republican states. In that case, the judge said the Republicans lacked standing to bring their lawsuit because they had yet to suffer any harm under Biden's order. The ruling by Kane, a Trump appointee, follows a ruling by another Louisiana judge last summer that struck down a separate Biden attempt to address greenhouse gas emissions by suspending new oil and gas leases on federal lands and water. The judge in that case, U.S. District Judge Terry Doughty, is also a Trump appointee. In a sign of the shifting politics on the issue, a federal judge in Washington rejected a lease sale in the Gulf of Mexico, conducted largely in response to Doughty's ruling. U.S. District Judge Rudolph Contreras, an Obama appointee, threw out the lease sale, saying the administration did not adequately take into account its effect on greenhouse gas emissions. Boulder County, lifting of seasonal moratorium on lethal prairie dog control okayed by Amy Bounds, the Boulder Daily Camera. Boulder County commissioners agreed Thursday to lift a seasonal moratorium on lethal prairie dog control to better address burgeoning colonies on agricultural lands. The moratorium prohibited extermination on open space land designated as not suitable for prairie dogs from March 1st to May 31st, which is their breeding season. Lifting the moratorium allows the county to use direct lethal control at any time, but still only those designated spaces. Our focus is solely on these no prairie dog lands, said Mike Foster, agricultural resources manager. He said not using lethal control during breeding season means the open space staffers must contend with up to four times more prairie dogs, plus the juveniles pushed out of the burrows recolonizing cleared areas. Lethal methods should get colonies under better control, so there's less need for extermination in the future, he added. We are literally fighting an uphill battle with the prairie dogs and how quickly they can recolonize an area we have cleared, he said. Commissioners said they liked that getting the prairie dog populations under control on agricultural lands would make it easier for farmers leasing the land, as well as make the county better neighbors to those with adjacent properties. County workers had made a very good case for eliminating the moratorium, Commissioner Claire Levy said. They also praised the goal of reducing the need for extermination in the future. What was persuasive to me is doing this, we will actually end up having less lethal control of prairie dogs, Commissioner Matt Jones said. The county's prairie dog management plan, first approved in 1999, designates areas within the county open space system into three categories: habitat conservation areas, which are suitable prairie dog habitats, multiple objective areas, which can support prairie dogs, as well as other activities such as trails or grazing, and no prairie dog areas, which have been deemed inappropriate for prairie dogs by virtue of their land uses. Namely, no prairie dogs areas are those where agricultural operations take place. Issues created by colonies on mainly agricultural lands include denuding grasses and other vegetation, allowing for erosion of the topsoil, Foster said. Another concern is the risk of livestock injury from stepping in burrows. The county has designated about 17,000 acres of open space as no prairie dog lands. About 768 of those acres have prairie dogs living there, or about 4% of the total. The county budgets about $225,000 annually for prairie dog control on those lands, or about 20% of the total revenue the county receives from its agricultural leases. Along with lethal removal using carbon monoxide, the county uses fencing and trapping to control its prairie dog populations. One example given to illustrate the challenges was the area east of Loggerman Reservoir, which was almost cleared of prairie dog colonies in 2018, county officials said. 2 years later, the area was recolonized, and the county has since struggled to reduce the number of colonies. About a dozen people spoke during a public hearing on the change. Several shared concerns that allowing lethal control at all times could reduce a food source for predators, especially birds of prey. A specific area of concern is Stearns Lake, a nesting site for eagles on the Rock Creek Farm property. Foster responded that lethal control won't be used during nesting season, adding there is a colony on land to the south that's designated as suitable for prairie dogs. Crystal Markovich of Nederland said she would prefer barriers to lethal methods and suggested using controlled burns to make prairie dog suitable properties more attractive. Others, including farmers and neighbors of properties with prairie dogs colonies, despite a no prairie dog designation, said it's expensive and time-consuming to keep prairie dogs off their properties. No prairie dogs means no prairie dogs, said Suzanne Webble of Longmont, whose farm is near an open space property. The prairie dogs are out of control. We can watch them marching up the road to get to our farms. Canada. Judge orders blockade to end. Demonstrators have blocked a bridge over COVID restrictions. By Rob Gillies, Tom Krischer, and Mike Householder, The Associated Press. Windsor, Ontario. A judge on Friday ordered protesters at the Ambassador Bridge over the U.S.-Canadian border to end the five-day-old blockade that has disrupted the flow of goods between the two countries and forced the auto industry on both sides to roll back production. It was not immediately clear when or if law enforcement officers would be sent in to remove the demonstrators who parked their pickups and other vehicles in a bumper-to-bumper protest against the country's COVID-19 restrictions and an outpouring of fury toward Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his Liberal government. Windsor police immediately warned that anyone blocking the streets could be subject to arrest and their vehicles may be seized. Thank you for joining us for the Saturday, February 12, 2022 reading of the Denver Post. My name is Doug Crane.